You're listening to our summer spin-off show from Arsenal for Democracy. As we discussed on the last episode, the Arsenal for Democracy radio show is going on hiatus at WVUD, but we're continuing with a podcast version this summer, a little bit looser and more free form, since we're not on the air and don't have the exact time constraints and having to put the promos in and everything. So joining me as usual this week, we have on the line Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey.
And also on the line from Idaho, Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Bill. Hey, Nate.
So we wanted to talk this week about some interesting stuff. Because we really haven't been talking that much about 2020 presidential campaign stuff, on the Arsenal for Democracy radio episodes. And that was for a number of reasons. Partly, I think it can be kind of just boring to just do like the horse race coverage or whatever. But we've definitely delved into some of the policy aspects. But there was some really interesting stuff, I thought, coming out of the Bernie Sanders campaign that in the last couple of weeks that might be interesting. One of his top staff people, I guess he's technically on the Senate side rather than the campaign side. It's a little hard to keep track sometimes. Highlighted that there was that Bernie Sanders had rolled out a proposal to expand worker ownership, a proposal for a Wall Street speculation tax, a proposal to end predatory lending, a huge proposal on public education, which I'm not sure how much time we'll have to get into that, but that was enormous and then sort of just like went by without much coverage, I felt like. And then a plan to revitalize rural America. So I wanted to talk about some of these as I thought they were kind of interesting. I think also a lot of this has been sort of a response to this. There was this interesting discourse early on with the Elizabeth Warren campaign where you had people saying like, oh, she's rolling out all these great policy ideas, but it's not getting her anywhere. And like, this would be really disappointing and bad for the process if like, you know, pushing this policy agenda really didn't get you any traction. But eventually she actually did start getting traction. So now there's like a different narrative, which is like, oh, you know, Elizabeth Warren's the only one rolling out these like detailed policy programs and stuff like that, which then the Sanders people have been pushing back on that and saying, I mean, that doesn't really make sense. We've also been releasing big policies. And in many cases, a lot of their policies go a lot further and broader, I think, than the Elizabeth Warren ones. Nate, you looked into a number of articles on some of these things, especially the one that was kind of gathering a lot of attention, which the press release for that was legislative package introduced to encourage employee-owned companies, but originally had been titled something like Bernie Sanders introduces legislation for workers to own the means of production. I don't know at what point they revised the heading on that, but anyway, that's what the sort of article coverage of this anyway was basically calling it that. And then I know you had looked at some comparisons, as we like to do on the show, to what was going on in UK labor. So walk us through a little bit of this means of production legislation, Nate.
Yeah, was it the actual name of the legislation, means of production, or was it just, it was like a...
Well, there was, it was like a, I think there was a couple different things, right? There was
inclusive ownership funds, that's what it was. And wasn't part of this lifting from like, I think People's Policy Project had their like sovereign wealth fund thingy.
Yeah, well, one of the articles, actually, I think it was the Vox article, did a long breakdown kind of comparing and contrasting and said that fundamentally they're kind of, and they were also comparing to the Corbyn McDonnell stuff that you were going to talk about with labor, that like the big difference there is that there a sovereign wealth fund is kind of an abstract way of giving people, you know, shares in a lot of different companies, as opposed to these proposals, which are give workers ownership stakes in their own companies.
Yeah, so it would, I don't think they have the exact percentage of what shares that would require corporations to contribute, and they also don't think they've worked out whether it would be voting or non-voting shares yet, but I think the aim is to go up to around 50% or to gradually build up to 50%. And I think in UK, the proposed plan only maxed out at 10% employee ownership. So... But I think it looks like they are trying to do sort of a gradual, a lot of references to the Maidar plan in Sweden in the 70s. And but I guess the basic idea would be to, create these funds that would, take the returns of companies and give it back to workers, and they would gain ownership of their firms. And it sounds like it's polling relatively popularly, or at least they tried out one poll, YouGov Democracy Collab, 55% would support requiring companies to gradually transfer their half their equity into worker-controlled inclusive ownership funds that would pay all workers a dividend, and only 20% oppose. And this article, and I think a New Yorker or New York magazine article, sort of showed that was somewhat more popular, even amongst Republicans, than like straight up like tax redistribution type policies would have been. So, I mean, this is like not really talked about, these types of policies, or they haven't been until recently, like with Warren's co-determination plan that we talked about last year, and all these new types of plans. So it maybe just not as polarized. Maybe eventually Fox News will get on that, but this was sort of like the political spin on it, just like, oh, this actually might be relatively popular.
Yeah, well, I mean, that crank guy, Maryland Congressman, former Maryland Congressman John Delaney, who's for some reason running for president and was the one who got out there like early before everyone else in like early 2017. He's going and giving these ranting speeches denouncing Medicare for All and saying that it's unacceptable to have the Democratic nominee be for Medicare for All. I think he's a former Goldman Sachs guy, so huge surprise there. Anyway, but like, as you say, people like him aren't out there, you know, giving speeches denouncing the ownership of the means of production, which is, and again, not because they agree with it, but just because it doesn't seem to be on their radar yet. Rachel, any thoughts on this?
I think yeah, we just haven't seen much pushback on it because people aren't familiar with it. Like my knowledge is admittedly very shallow. I know Winco, which is a local grocery store chain that is actually quite popular and has expanded as far east as Texas, is employee owned, and it seems to make a huge difference in the attitude of the employees. So I think it's definitely a very positive thing, just from what I've seen in my limited experience. The workers are happier. They look like they're treated better because they have ownership in the company, and they do have a voice in how the company is run. I know like King Arthur Flour is a worker-owned company, so I always try to buy King Arthur Flour.
It's also
So
tasty.
it is, yeah, it just makes great food. So
Wait, are you
I
guys
from
just
what
like eating flour straight up so that you can
no,
compare
but
different
no.
types
King
of
Arthur
flour?
Flour is
It
like
makes
Northeastern as
superior
well.
No, I know
I've been
that.
to
I have King Arthur flour in the house too.
I've been
Yeah.
to their new head sandwich shop or whatever, but anyway.
I'm not just eating flour out of the bag, so
Seems
and they're
like
bring it
you are,
in.
Rachel. Seems like you are.
Tilt your head back and just pour it
Yeah,
in.
just pour it down. But their cookbook is like my baking Bible,
That's
so
true. I have that. My mom has that one, I think, too. Yeah.
it's amazing. So from what my limited experience is with worker-owned companies, they're more productive, the employees are happier, morale's better, and they have a voice in how things are run. So obviously there's a stake in making sure the company is successful, whereas when there's like a board of stockholders, they are trying to just pool the money out of the company and kind of put it in the pockets of the stakeholders. And there's not really an interest in making sure things are successful in the long term. It's just that quarter to quarter, they're profitable at no matter like the cost. So I think this is a really great plan.
Yeah, Rachel, to back up what you're saying there, from the what there's like a Washington Post chart, I guess, that was cited in the Intelligencer New York Mag thing, basically showing how from 72 to 2016, shareholder payouts went from 1.8% to 3.1%, while wages in the same period fell from 21.6% to about 11.5%, or wages as a share of total assets. So this, yeah, it's basically showing one trend line that's going up with some spikes depending on the economy. Just they're shoveling out money to their shareholders, and then wages, meanwhile, are just like going down.
I think actually we did a whole episode on that specific topic a few years back on the show, although at this point it was probably 4 or so years ago, if I had to guess. But basically, you know, it's not just that they're massively increasing the shareholder payouts, which overwhelmingly means the very small, very, very, very small percentage of Americans who own substantial numbers of shares. We're not really talking that, you know, much about the like pension funds or whatever. There was, I'm looking back over the previous ArsenalForDemocracy.com posts and radio episodes about that to see when that was. But yeah, 2015, there was a whole report from the Roosevelt Institute that was like, it's not just the problem of doing these shareholder payouts, it's how they're funding them and what they're doing, what they could be doing with the money instead, which is one of the reasons. I mean, partly the Bernie Sanders plan, as Nate said at the beginning, there's a bunch of gaps in that particular plan in terms of like how far this would actually go and what it would do, which this maybe doesn't
address.
Not even
sure they've rolled out the full thing yet, because they're talking about it being forthcoming and sort of contrasting it with the whole like co-determination thing. So Warren had it minimum at 2/5, and I think Tammy Baldwin, Wisconsin senator, also had a bill that would have done like 1/3. So it's like an idea that seems to be gaining some sort of traction. So,
well, I mean, just sort of briefly to close that loop, like the other thing is there were a couple people, you know, I saw people like real socialists on Twitter saying like, oh wow, this is, you know, he's launching this means of production stuff, etc., you know, this is great real socialism, and where are the other presidential candidates on this? And then I'm like looking into the actual press release, and you see like Kirsten Gillibrand, who is another presidential candidate, is a co-introducer, Patrick Leahy, Maggie Hassan, Jean Shaheen. I mean, these are not like particularly left-wing senators. And then Elizabeth Warren is also a lead sponsor on one of the other bills, as is Sherrod Brown. So like there's definitely a limit at the moment to how, well, like what they're actually proposing. But yeah, I mean, just to go back briefly.
Well, there's the ESOP, employee stock ownership plans, where a lot of those, I think a bunch of people signed on, as you were saying, Leahy, Hassan, Shaheen,
right,
and everyone.
I mean, as you say, there's this big gap between owning parts of the company in terms of getting these profit payouts versus governing the company, right? That's a huge difference. So, you know, in terms of, to go back to that 2015 stuff, that Roosevelt Institute paper was basically showing that they, you know, instead of borrowing money to like build a new factory or something, which we talked about in the episode on that, these companies were literally borrowing money to make these dividend payouts and stuff like that, and do stock buybacks as well, which is another way of, you know, paying off the shareholders essentially. This was potentially setting up a number of these companies, not just very short termist, which creates very, you know, big problems over the long run, but it was potentially setting them up to be in a similar position as a lot of these Japanese companies that, you know, ended up being called, you know, nicknamed zombie corporations, where the amount of money that they were, you know, spending on debt service was actually exceeding, you know, what they were taking in terms of revenues and stuff like that, or at least they couldn't do any expansions and so forth, and they couldn't pay off the debt because they weren't making enough money. They were only making enough money to keep making payments on the debt. And to get back to this issue of the governance thing, I mean, that's what we talked about on that previous episode that Nate referenced earlier, which is that Elizabeth Warren, I will acknowledge that was, you know, probably a more ambitious plan, at least for now. She was saying that 40% of the corporate board members have to be elected by workers. Like, that goes a lot further. And we know, as we talked about before, that the co-determination model, you know, sort of heavily pioneered in West Germany, has led to corporations being actually more able to think long term than the short-term, you know, shareholder revolution style, you know, American corporations. There was also, as we've talked about previously on the show, the 2016 proposal by Hillary Clinton that would have offered a tax break for profit sharing payments, sort of a bewildering proposal that's also not really co-determination. So again, remains to be seen, you know, what exactly happens here. But, you know, then we can also look at the 2018 articles from, you know, Jacobin or the references in the recent Vox article talking about the Labour Party in the UK and John McDonnell. There was a Guardian article. We'll have all these links up at arsenalfordemocracy.com as usual. The plan from Britain was a 10% of all equity had to be transferred in. These are firms with at least 250 employees. They had to be transferred into worker owned and controlled funds over a 10-year period. And that would pay out various dividends and so forth. They again contrast it with that plan that Nate referenced earlier, the Meidner plan from Sweden, which was an abortive plan that was never fully realized, that would have gone up to 50%, in which point you do have, you know, effective governing control as well as part of this. So interesting to sort of see this dynamic play out. And again, like, I'm acknowledging here that some of this stuff is still pretty vague and that, you know, the corporate governance stuff was a little clearer, at least in Elizabeth Warren's plan. Rachel, I was curious. I think I had talked about this with a couple other people, but I don't think you were part of those discussions. It seems to me a little, I've been kind of noticing that some people, especially maybe they're self-selecting on social media or whatever, seem really excited about these calculator tools that Elizabeth Warren has that'll be like, here's how much money you could save at your income level and whatever on, you know, student loan payments or childcare payments under Elizabeth Warren's plan. And then they, you know, keep going, Warren has a plan for that and so forth. I was wondering what you think about that. I found it a little bit like odd, because part of the issue here with the Bernie Sanders stuff is that it tends to be a little bit less sort of wonky specific, in part because he's usually proposing more universal proposals.
I have to admit, I haven't seen that really. I've seen like the hashtag Warren has a plan for it, but I haven't really seen the calculator.
Maybe don't follow enough mainline libs who supported Martin O'Malley in 2015. It's like, you know, oh, I found out I would save, you know, X amount of money on my monthly student loan payments or my overall student loan debt, as opposed to like, I mean, why is that the plan, to be like income-based loan cancellation or partial forgiveness, as opposed to just wiping it all out, which we've talked about before? I mean, you should save all the money in, you know, the full amount.
Yeah, it seems like that incremental change, like kind of means testing sort of thing, that isn't as attractive as saying, hey, we'll forgive your debt and therefore you won't have any debt, any student loan payments in the foreseeable future. So, I haven't actually seen that, what you're referring to, but I don't see it being super attractive or as attractive a message as saying, yeah, we're going to forgive your debt. We're going to raise up this cohort that has been kind of screwed over in the past and raise them all up and allow them to attain these quote unquote adult milestones that have been eluding us, like home ownership or having children or being able to live a good lifestyle that's not just living paycheck to paycheck. So I think if a more universal message about how this generation has been the economy has been stacked against them and the government has done nothing to really help them is a more attractive message.
It seems like also there's been a little bit of walking back from Warren on some of the Medicare for All stuff. Like, I started seeing phrasing pop up about like multiple pathways to get there and stuff, which,
yeah, she had a thing about that.
I feel like is not really an accurate representation. I don't know. It's just like, you know, I try not to like criticize her too much, because I think, you know, relative to a lot of the field, she's, you know, better than a lot of the choices or whatever. But I'm just like still sort of grappling, because there's been a lot of like discourse, especially on left Twitter, where like a bunch of people will be like, actually, like Warren's better than Bernie Sanders now. It's like, maybe.
I don't know about that one.
I've noticed like a couple different groups, like a lot of like sort of professional class type Hillary supporters, or they would have been last time. And like, if Hillary had been proposing these same policies, maybe they would have gone for it, but they were arguing that these were basically impossible last time. And now that Warren has proposed them, they're like, all right, boom.
Yeah, Warren has a plan for that. Yeah.
We're Team Warren now. She's got a plan for that. Bernie can't get anything done. He's old, blah, blah, blah. So
he's a white man.
We're Warren. Yeah. And then, yeah, you also have a couple people on, not just a couple people, a decent amount of people on left Twitter are like, actually, yeah, oh, Warren is wonky. So there we go. And yeah, it's a little unclear what exactly is going to happen from that.
I also couldn't, I felt bothered. The same thing that we saw, that disingenuous discourse in like 2016, 2017 around the free college stuff. I mean, this originates sort of in the 2016 primary, like capital D discourse, where you had people just bizarrely like being like, well, free college would be a giveaway to rich people because the upper middle class utilizes college more than poor people, except that student debt cancellation, I mean, that overwhelmingly affects lower income people by far. I mean, the overall student debt burden, like in terms of numbers, that's like lower income people. And usually minorities have been preyed upon, especially as we've talked about before. Secondly, like it becomes this sort of self-fulfilling thing where, you know, if you've got more upper middle class people who go to college because they have the option to go to college financially, then of course more of them are going to college than lower income people, and this might give lower income people a path to go to college. Third, of course, is just the disingenuousness of like, we're talking about making state schools free. No one's going to be like, the government will give you, like, let you go to Harvard for free. Like, that's a weird, like, what is the, that's not the conversation we're having. And I then saw this exact argument then extended to the childcare issue. And I was just baffled by that because they were like, oh, I love this calculator on Elizabeth Warren's website where I can see at my income level how much money I would save on childcare under her plan. And I was like, why would you not just have a universal childcare plan? And I started getting, cause like, I asked this and I was curious, but you know, some people were like, well, I think it would be really hard to like roll out, you know, state provided, you know, standardized pre kindergarten level, like, or daycare or anything, you know, infant care, daycare, preschool, all of that, like state sponsored, like it's, that'd be a lot to roll out. I'm like, okay. Not necessarily disagreeing with that, but it seems like a little bit of missing the forest for the trees in that, like, we have this huge demand for childcare. It needs to be free. Let's figure out how we do it. Obviously, there's going to be a big transformation there. But then the, like, worse argument was, like, because they were like, well, okay, so that's maybe a long-term goal, but, like, in the short term, what are you going to do? Just give, like, have the government, you know, give everyone money to pay off their, like, childcare costs for these private providers or whatever. I was like, I don't know. I mean, I hadn't stopped to think about it that long, but maybe, like, is that so bad? And immediately they jumped to like the, so you want the federal government to pay, like, you know, the nanny for the, this 1%, you know, or 0.1% or whatever. I'm like, they're probably not going to use the government money to do that for the same reason that like a extremely rich billionaire is not going to send their kid to state school just because it's free under a free college plan for free state schools. Like that doesn't make sense to me. And then they roll out this graph that we're like, overwhelmingly upper middle class people utilize childcare and spend more on childcare than low income people do. So therefore any plan that you're talking about, universal plan, would be a huge giveaway if it's not, you know, means tested or income capped or whatever, and it's not income adjusted in terms of the payments from the government. You know, that would be a huge giveaway to the upper middle class. And someone was like, do you not understand the problem with this graph? And they were like, no, I don't. What's the problem? And I'm like, okay, well, I'm not going to get into a heated back and forth about this, but obviously it's sort of a, again, self-fulfilling prophecy where if you say that upper middle class people spend all the money on childcare and low income people don't, you shouldn't give out money for childcare because it won't benefit low income people, as opposed to the obvious conclusion that probably a bunch of low income people would now be able to spend more money on childcare. Like, so I feel like it's going around and around in circles. I mean, ultimately, some of the stuff with calculators is just like basically data harvesting and whatever for the Elizabeth Warren campaign or getting people digitally involved.
Have a calculator
fine. Like, of course, Hillary had, like, that was the whole campaign there. But, you know, I don't know this. Like, I'm again not really trying to like hate on the Elizabeth Warren stuff because I like that she, you know, the energy that she's bringing on some of this policy stuff. And I agree that, you know, Bernie has these areas that he also needs to work on. But I am a little bit confused on some of the discourse around around this. And like, it seems very clear to me, and I feel like a lot of people aren't seeing it, that she's not proposing these like universal solutions. And it's still more, it's like maybe the progressive edge of like the sort of Democratic Party technocracy, but it's still like within that standard vein in a way that the Sanders stuff isn't. I mean, maybe I'm way off base here. I don't know.
No, I don't think you are. I think a lot of what I've seen from her is she's trying to make a more compassionate capitalism, and Bernie's not. And so I think while, like you said, she's on the edge of this like progressive liberalism, it just isn't challenging the systemic issues at play here.
Nate?
Yeah, I mean, just if Warren becomes president, that's probably going to be a lot better than the situation we have right now. So I'm not going to complain about it heavily, although her other plans seem to be involving what, like, end climate change so the military can fight better or something.
Right. It was we need to, like, reduce the security threats to the military and make sure that our tanks don't run out of oil or whatever. Like, it's just like, wait, what?
It's like the U.S. military would be like buried in a big avalanche or something, or like,
right, that's the joke, right? Cyclone. Is that if you wanted to like cut U.S. carbon emissions by a lot overnight, you would just shut down the U.S. military and close all the bases.
Yeah, like all the ships that are like running into each other and Russian ships out in like the Pacific or whatever, and sure, they're not.
Yeah, I wonder how much fuel we burn on those like freedom of navigation exercises in the Taiwan Strait. Like, what is the point of any of those? I mean, that's a rhetorical question. At me. But I just, yeah, it's real silly. No, I to go back, I mentioned this earlier, but like, so obviously, you know, a little bit hazy on some of this means of production stuff that was getting a little bit hyped up on Twitter, but like, I don't know if people read this. I read through the whole thing, the Bernie Sanders Thurgood Marshall plan for public education, and then I really didn't see a lot of discussion about it, other than like obviously some real psychos like Jonathan Chait, you know, whose wife is like a charter schools person, just like losing their mind about it. Yeah, that was the reason for it. But like, he was almost the only person I felt like who really talked about it. It's this long, long piece, a Thurgood Marshall plan for public education. Obviously, I can't read from it because it's so long. But like, right off the bat, it's like aggressively like, we need to combat school segregation, and here's like what the causes of continued segregation are and like what the presidency could do, which, you know, for all the talk about can Bernie Sanders actually implement this stuff, a bunch of his things are like, we have the titles in place in the existing code, but they're not being enforced by the Department of Education or the court system. The second point was just complete profit elimination from charter schools in this country, which some people were like, well, maybe just go all the way and say no charter schools. But that's a little bit more of a complicated thing than this, which is just like, there shouldn't be, you know, because some of them are nonprofits that are kind of getting away with it. And then there's others that are special model that's different. But like, yeah, ending the profit motive in charter schools, like, that's a big one. And there was a bunch of people, you know, the charter schools Democrats who are really feeling like they're on the back foot right now, I think, with good reason, are all like, you know, what's the drill tweet that's like, you know, I mean, this is the equivalent of this is like, you know, I help black kids, I help Latino kids, and nobody thanks me, you know, like that's the attitude that these people are having, which is like, I can't believe I'm getting attacked for all of my heroic work as a white person to save these kids from the public schools. And it's like asterisk 10% of them and only under certain conditions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's like, but that's the whole like aesthetic of the whole charter school movement from the beginning, like the whole like movie Waiting for Superman or whatever. Yeah. I remember when that was a thing. And
well,
like, all
I would
of it
say
is, like,
not from the beginning, right? Because the beginning of of the charter schools movement is Southern segregationists trying to create whites-only schools. Like, but yeah, the Northeastern version. Exactly.
Yeah, Northeastern.
The Obama-era thing.
They would have had no chance to graduate, so like we set up a for-profit charter. So
right, is make the inner-city public schools worse, but also don't send any minorities to the white schools in the suburbs. Or, which, by the way, another thing here is like this opening up with let's tackle school segregation is just a huge shot across the bow at Joe Biden. Just which that audio, did you guys listen to the audio that surfaced from 1973, his first year in the Senate, where he was like just listing off all these like Southern segregationist senators that he was now suddenly friends with in his first year in office, and like what great mentors they were and stuff. And then he's like going on about this is good for the Negro in the South. And it's like, Jesus, what is your deal, dude? Like, and he's like, he keeps on being like, yeah, they've really moderated and come around on these issues or whatever. And it's like, no, they haven't. And also you oppose school busing. Like that's your whole thing at the beginning of his career. Anyway, and then there's the really ambitious thing in this, of course, is equitable funding for public schools, which is like Bernie Sanders. And this is very controversial coming from a place like Vermont, you know, because this is the sort of the New England model here, and especially true in Vermont. Also Massachusetts, where Nate and I are, most school districts are funded out of local property tax revenue, which is, as he says, results in unconscionable inequalities. So then the federal government, and then he takes the opposite approach. He's like, no more standardized test reliance to fix this and whatever. Like, we're just going to have a baseline, which is what they do in Massachusetts. It hasn't been updated since the early 90s, but the state of Massachusetts has a formula that says each district gets this as baseline funding from the state. The problem is then they also say that the cities and towns can do whatever above and beyond that baseline, you know, and some districts obviously have the resources for that. But anyway, this would at least, like, as they said, rethink the link between property taxes and education and establish a national per pupil spending floor. And then there were various other things related to that. There's a bunch of stuff related to the Disabilities Education Act, a bunch of things about paying teachers more, expanding after school and summer education programs, universal school meals, which that's another shot at the like charter schools, because a lot of those charter schools try to, at least the ones in Delaware, they'll be like, because they're the old, like the Southern model as opposed to the Northeastern model usually, which is like, well, we're just going to figure out ways to not provide free breakfast and lunch if we can avoid it, because then the right people will come here and the wrong people won't. And then he talks about community schools, school infrastructure, which this is crazy too, because we talk about roads and bridges falling apart, but like, he notes a 2014 study found that at least 53% of the nation's schools need immediate repair. And basically are falling apart. And, you know, there's stories abound about heating systems giving out in the winter, ceilings leaking during storms, mold accumulating in plain sight. This is unacceptable and has got to change. And, you know, talking about that. And then finally make schools a safe and inclusive place for all, which is about things like LGBTQ issues, Title IX enforcement, gun violence, things like that, and immigration rights, of course. So anyway, I don't know, like the whole like, to some degree, there's this truth about the, you know, Warren has a plan for that. But then on the other hand, you have stuff like this, which I feel like isn't getting that kind of attention. It's like, this is a really ambitious and good plan. So like, he also has these plans. I don't know. I just thought that was kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah. Like you said, the only thing I heard was like, yeah, Jonathan Chait, like freaking out about the charter school attacks. But a lot of these are very important to me as an Idahoan who kind of grew up in a rural, like I went to a suburban school, but it was still very rural as I was growing up. And a lot of these are very impactful for rural schools because, yeah, we did have to rely on property taxes and we were an economically depressed community, I think is like the official term for it. And so having that, having that equity in funding is really important. And I know I got, I was pretty lucky. I got a leg up because our school district paid for students to take the AP tests, which can transfer to college credits. So I basically got 12 college credits for free. Just kind of, they were generic and they didn't really apply to my graduation requirements except for like the number of credits. But still, that was enough to like give me a comfortable cushion during my college schooling. So I know I was super lucky. That's not always the case. And those tests cost $90 a piece. And as someone who grew up really poor, that was definitely something I could not have afforded without the school stepping up and providing that. So that was super big for me.
Rachel, I know also right before we hit record, you mentioned noticing out of the Sanders proposals about predatory lending that you were noticing something about Idaho in there. Was there an Idaho connection on the predatory lending thing?
Yes. So before, I believe, 1978, when there was a Supreme Court decision, Marquette National Bank v. First of Omaha Service Corp, which concluded that national banks could charge whatever interest rate they wanted if they moved to a state without a usury law. Before that time, Idaho had a cap on interest rates at 12%, which is huge to me. I had no idea that was on the books back then. Right now, we have a proliferation of those title loan or payday loan businesses. So that's kind of shocking that was part of our history. And well, I guess Idaho was good in the 70s. Let's just say that. Much better than it is now politically, for sure. So that I think it's ambitious. I think Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are introducing the Loan Shark Prevention Act, which I believe is capping. Where did they want to cap interest? Like, wasn't it 15% or something like that? So they want to prevent. They
yeah,
want to
15%.
Reinstitute. Yeah, so I think that's huge because I know some states have kind of tried to ban these and have been successful, but and a lot of states still allow these payday lenders, and they carry an average interest rate of 391%, and some can reach as high as 900%, which is insane. And they are, again, putting the emphasis on postal banking, which we have talked about in the past, and Bernie has been pretty outspoken about. So that is super important.
I liked that the official campaign rollout of this says the Bible and virtually every major religion on earth has a term for this practice. It's called usury. In the Divine Comedy, Dante reserved a special place in the seventh circle of hell for people who charged usurious interest rates. Today, we don't need the hellfire, the pitchforks, or the rivers of boiling blood, but we do need a national usury law that caps interest rates on credit cards and consumer loans at 15%. Although, as I was reading that, I was also thinking, well, we could do Sharia law rules on usury. And then they end up with the Islamic banking where they're like, all right, so you're trying to buy a car. We can't charge interest, so we're going to have the bank buy it. Then we're going to have the bank sell it to you on a payment plan at a marked up total that is equal to what the interest rate would be. And it's like, I think that's sort of not really the that's the letter of the guideline, not the spirit of it. Yeah, so that's, they mentioned here as well about that it's, you know, it's a $1 trillion now in credit card debt and people desperately need relief. And that was why they came up with this interest rate cap of 15%. That's something I feel like, you know, 2007, 8, and 9, we hear this, you know, stuff about the subprime mortgages on homes. Then, you know, last election cycle or presidential election cycle, we're hearing a lot more about student loan debt and college costs. The next two big things that are definitely going to be on the horizon are, I mean, you know, credit card debt's kind of always floating around there in the back, but it is pretty significant in terms of totals now, and in this country. And then also, car loans, you know, speaking of, Sharia law for my pickup truck, you know, it's like the total burdens and the rising sort of scammy arbitrage going on. Like, I don't know. I know there's some shady stuff involving subprime auto loans that's happening, which is going to clearly be a problem very soon. But also the usury stuff where a bunch of Silicon Valley people are like, we're going to disrupt the usury industry. And I keep getting angrier every time I see the ads for this. But there's that new app that's like, I'm a teacher and I need to buy school supplies. So I use this thing to get a payday loan, but they don't call it that, you know. And I was like, this is awful. And then it was even worse because I was listening. I don't know, Nate, you probably heard this episode, right? There was a recent episode of Trash Future, the podcast in Britain, where they were talking about this specific app and like how does it sort of work and make money. And it starts off real creepy because the origins of the company was this guy who like worked at some other company and kept fronting money to his employees because they were like, oh, like I don't need extra money, but I need it today rather than in 2 weeks to be able to make this payment. So he started like kind of like pre-lending people stuff or whatever. And then was like, well, I got to keep this going after I leave that company. So that's creepy to begin with. But then the like way worse thing was that the model is actually that people are pooling the money together to front these loans, which, I mean, given how all of the other Silicon Valley disruption apps have worked, that will go immediately from, oh, we're just all helping each other out with our little resources to like a bunch of billionaires being like, yeah, I'm a member. Here's a pool of money. Now I'm going to make even more money off of it. And then instead of charging interest, they have a voluntary tipping system. If you don't tip in the voluntary system, then you're basically cut off from using it in the future, more or less. And if you do tip, well, the tips are like 400% interest or something bonkers. It was wild. So I was like, okay, so they're not just a bad ad campaign for clearly what's a payday loan. This is truly the disruption of the payday loan industry by just like somehow making it even way worse than it already was. I mean, it's the same thing with Uber, right? Like, or Lyft or any of those things. It's like, no one was really psyched about the model that taxi cabs are operated under. And there's clearly a lot of problems with those as well. And a lot of, you know, very impoverished cab drivers, but like this also didn't fix it. This made the thing worse. Thanks, disruptors. Anyway, so yeah, that was something that was kind of on my radar. So it was interesting. So I wanted to do a deep dive this week on some of these policies, you know, and I encourage people to check those out. Any closing thoughts as we wrap up this first of our summer podcast episodes?
I just wanted to point out Bernie's Revitalizing Rural America plan, which has a prominent picture of Bernie on a tractor looking very pleased and happy about being on a tractor. He does look presidential. So I want to encourage everyone to take a look at that, because that's another big issue that's affecting a huge segment of the population, especially in the Midwest.
Tractor so. Boy. Nate, your closing thoughts?
I guess something that happened recently was the whole Biden Hyde Amendment.
Yeah, we might have to hit that one up next week. I was thinking about that as we were starting to record today. I was like, oh yeah, that also happened this week. But I feel like,
well, because like he was doubling down one moment and then like completely flipped on it the next.
I think we got to do a whole episode on that. Probably
been dropping in the polls a bit, and then like I think Warren has been sort of picking up some of that slack. So she's at 15% now in some polls. So I mean, it seems like there's going to be an attempt to like have a Warren surge coming. And I mean, if she takes Biden's numbers, then that might be good, but we'll see.
Well, I mean, not to like get too, you know, into the weeds on it, but it seems like some of the numbers that he's losing after his little announcement bump are going to Warren, which, fine, not necessarily bad in its own right. But then you have all these really cynical, like, inside party operators who clearly never in a million years want Warren as the nominee nor plan to vote for her, and who are like, I'm really liking this Warren stuff. And it's just like,
there's
you
a
hate
lot
of all
really
of this
disingenuous
you hate
stuff.
All of this.
I mean, I wonder what the plan, like if Warren runs and then loses, and then this will be, oh, we can't have any progressive policy. Or
I think it's going to be, we can't have policy.
Yeah.
Like, never again. No issue discussion.
And then.
As you say, Nate, I think that we're going to have to, you know, we have to talk about the Hyde stuff. We don't want to get too off topic this week, so we will hit that up next week probably, put that on the docket. And I think related to that is the issue of well, there's some of these other things like the Dems not doing a climate debate and giving a really like bad
very
answer
cool.
on that.
Let's have no questions about it either, like last time.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw today that it's been 15 years since there was a substantive like climate change question in one of the major general election debates, because the like there weren't any in the last cycle, and then like the 2008 there was like one question that was really just about quote-unquote energy independence. But anyway, we'll get into that next week. We'll put on the agenda to talk about Hyde and talk about the climate stuff. But yeah, this was I think an interesting place to start for our summer discussions. So Nate, thanks for being on this week.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Rachel.
Rachel, thank you as well.
Thanks, Bill.
I don't know how to end this because I haven't had to do it without the pre-recorded ending. So anyway, I'm just going to stop recording for now and figure it out later. Thank you.